at the studios of Key West.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Historically, South Florida is known for renegades and lawbreakers, and today's crime history segment covers a period of amazing murders, drug activity, and corruption. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. The most sensational crime of the 1960s was the murder of tycoon Jacques Mosler in Key Biscayne. His former model wife, Candy, and her lover were defendants in a wildly salacious trial that had Miami abuzz. Then who can forget the human boat lift from Mariel, where, among others, thousands of Cuban criminals and mental cases were sent to Florida. At the same time, intense race rioting occurred in 1980 after four white cops were acquitted of beating an African-American motorcyclist to death. Historian Dr. Paul George waiting in the wings. First, it's news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman is today's Topical Currents special edition. Bonnie, we have a long way to go on this one, and
we
not
have
much time
long
to do
a long list of crimes. We've been sitting here thinking of even more. Everyone's coming up with even more.
Well, it's the concluding segment of a three-part series on South Florida crime history. Again, we have resident historian of the History Miami Museum, Dr. Paul, joining us.
And today's focus centers on notorious criminal acts from the 1960s into the 2000s. And, of course, there's plenty of material from some turbulent times.
Of course, Dr. George is a prolific author, a former history professor at Miami-Dade College, and gives remarkable history tours in both Miami-Dade and Broward.
Welcome to you. Good to have you back, Paul.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Where do we start? Okay, I'm going to pick one with so much intrigue because it's a love triangle, and it was nasty.
And has incest.
And has incest to boot and money. Candace Mosler and her nephew, Melvin Lane Powers, talk about their murdering her husband, Jacques Mosler.
The special editions of the newspaper.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Candace Mosler was this dazzling-looking lady who was married to a gentleman much older than she who was owned some banks in Miami, among other places. And his body was found in 1964 in a condominium in Key Biscayne. He'd been stabbed scores of times, beaten around the head. And, I mean, it was just brutal. And soon after, she and her nephew-slash-lover, Melvin Lane Powers, became prime suspects.
And that was her nephew?
It was her sister's son, 20 years her junior.
Okay.
And they became prime suspects, and they were eventually indicted for murder. The case was tried in that fabled courtroom 6-1 in the downtown courthouse, and they had a preeminent lawyer, Percy Foreman, out of Houston, Texas. And the trial was titillating, to put it mildly. In fact, at one point in the trial, there was so much salacious discussion about their relationship, Candace and Melvin Lane Powers, that the judge said, "We don't want anybody in this courtroom as part of the audience that's under 21 years of age."
Oh.
And the Miami News.
It was X-rated.
A
trial.
It was unreal.
I saw the
in Miami.
That Candace Mosler was a model, of course, and I've heard of hand models and professional beer pourers for commercials, but she was a toothpaste model. I didn't know that those existed.
Well, now did she use as her defense that he was killed during a botched burglary or something?
Well, the attorney, first of all, her attorney never called a witness, and what he came up with was the idea that Jacques Mosler was gay, and that it was a homosexual lover of his that killed him.
Oh.
And he just poked holes in the testimony of the prosecuting team. And he delivered a 6.5-hour closing address before the jury without ever calling a witness. And they went through 7 ballots, and on the 7th ballot they acquitted Powers and Candace, who then jumped into a gold-colored Cadillac outside of the courthouse, drove off, broke up within a year. Both are deceased now. But what a story.
When she died, her autopsy showed that she'd been a heavy drug user.
She had been, absolutely. And he passed away just a couple of years ago. Big article in the New York Times, his obituary, and he became sort of a wealthy land baron in Houston, Texas. What's interesting also about the salacious nature of it was that the Miami News, which had issued a blue streak for decades, actually had a pink streak during the course of the trial because there was so much coming out that was so sexually connected. But I think one of the great quotes came from the Chicago Tribune. This was international. And you had newspapers from everywhere covering this thing. The Chicago Tribune, in one of their editions, labeled the trial as, quote, lubricated by sex, nourished by sex, and varnished by sex, end quote. So it wasn't only a Miami kind of a thing.
When I first moved here in the early 70s, my first checking account was at Central National Bank. That was the Moslem.
That was his bank.
Yeah. Well, she would come
right
down
up the street from here.
And she would come down, matter of factly, for board meetings and all, because she inherited some of that bank. And so she was still in the area periodically, long after that.
Wow. All right. So that's Candace Mosler's story. And then in 68 is the kidnapping of Barbara Jane Mackel. That is incredible.
Gives
what
everybody
happened to her.
The heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, because it's everybody's fear.
And
tell us what happened to her.
Well, the claustrophobia thing. Barbara Jane Mackel has to be, and she's still alive, and has to have been an extraordinary human being. She was the daughter of Robert Mackel, one of the three brothers developing in southwest Florida, developing on Key Biscayne, developing Westwood Lake, way out west along Bird Road. And they were very, very wealthy people. Their wealth at the time was assessed at somewhere around $35 million in the mid-60s. And there was a guy named Gary Crist, who was on a lamb from the law in California, came to Miami, a brilliant guy, 23 years of age, already with a wife and a couple of children. Yeah, he had severed his connection with them, and he took a job at the Rosenstiel School. And he ran into a young lady from Honduras, Ruth Eisman Shire, and they became an item. And he said, you know, I've always had an idea for a perfect crime, and that is to kidnap the wealthy daughter of someone. And so he did research, including other places, at the downtown library's Florida room, and said, I've got my person. Barbara Jane Mackel, the daughter of one of the three Mackel brothers. She was going to school in Emory. Actually, after hours at the Rosenstiel School, built a casket, and he was so meticulous in everything, he varnished it. The imprint of the casket, because of the varnishing, was still in the parking lot there up until about 15 years ago when they blacktopped the lot again. Oh. And he went up to Emory with his girlfriend, and he went to a diner. It was a chilly night. Barbara Jane was in a hotel room with her mother and a good friend of hers who later became her husband. She had the flu. He stole a policeman's hat and jacket from a diner in Atlanta, found out where she was, knocked on the door, chloroformed Barbara Jane, chloroformed the mother, who was able to crawl out to the car and eventually raise enough ruckus to get the police to do it. Meanwhile, he took Barbara Jane to a burial spot in suburban Atlanta where the coffin was, buried her alive a couple feet below the surface, had a couple tubes, one for water, one for air, candy bars, and other things in the casket. But here she was, really ill with the flu. And there she lay for 83 hours. He came down to Miami, called the Mackels. I have your daughter. I want $500,000. And the serial numbers had to be after a certain year, so they couldn't be traced easily, in $20 bills. Picked it up at what then was called the Fair Isle Bridge at Bayshore Drive as you're moving into Coconut Grove. Ran back to his car. He had an old Volvo near the Rickenbacker Causeway entrance on the Miami side, and police showed up. The FBI hadn't alerted the police to stay out of this thing, and so he dropped his bag, took refuge in St. Peter and Paul Roman Catholic Church, spent the night in the choir loft. In fact, his rifle was still there years later. Called the Mackels again. This time, let's not mess it up, guys. Drove out to around Chrome Avenue and 8th Street, picked up $500,000, bolted, bought a boat, called the FBI from somewhere around the Atlantic Intracoastal Waterway in the Fort Pierce area, I believe, and said the victim is buried in such and such a place.
And so that's the only way she was found, is
right.
He told them, otherwise
she would have never made it, yeah.
I mean, she was there for almost 4 days.
Right, 83 hours. Gene Miller from the Miami Herald wrote a book called 83 Hours of Dawn, which was really a captivating book.
Did she even have a flashlight or anything?
Nothing. It was, in fact...
can't get any darker than that.
It was just, you couldn't get any darker. And what sustained her, she said later, was the thoughts of being back with her family and decorating the Christmas tree with them. The kidnapping took place in early December, about the 10th or 12th of December of 1968, and they found her. She heard voices as they were nearing, and she was crunched up. She was a tall lady, very young at this time, less than 21, was actually crunched up in the casket, but was able to, I guess, bang on the lid from the inside, and they heard her, and they got her, and within a matter of minutes, you know, the police who found her were just so emotional about it, and she said, I'm okay, Everything's going to be okay.
Wow.
And they caught Chris. He hadn't slept in a week. They caught his girlfriend, the accomplice, months later in Norman, Oklahoma. Very long story short, Gary Chris was convicted and sentenced, and was in a maximum security prison in Georgia. And he applied for parole about 10 years later at the end of the 70s. Yeah, he'd been in for about 10 years. And the Mackle family testified in his behalf for parole. That's how forgiving these people were. So he went off his dream. He was a genius, a demented genius, age 23 when it happened. Went off to medical school, couldn't get a residency in the United States, was able to practice, though, in Indiana, which allows felons to practice medicine. When word got out there that he was a felon, he was kind of like pushed out of the community. Ended up, once again, falling out of kink with the law, was running cocaine and aliens in the United States, was apprehended, served another federal prison term, is out. We don't know where he is.
He's still alive?
Still alive, the best of our knowledge.
We and now didn't he go 70s. By the name George Deacon?
Right. That was his alias during the kidnapping.
Yeah.
But it was a case that was headlines of our newspapers as well as Atlanta day after day.
I was aware of it up north. I remember it with that Mackle.
Just, a 23 years of age hatching something like this.
Unbelievable. And he was at the Rosenstiel School.
Rosenstiel School, yes. As a worker. And they had no idea of his background. He had forged everything.
Let's move along a little bit.
Let's take our break now.
Right,
we're part three and final part of our crime series for South Florida with Dr. Paul George, and we'll be right back.
It's Saturday morning, get up and stop yawning, take a walk with Dr. George. Categorically correct, historically walk with Dr. George. It's history with a flair, yet swear that he was there. Oh, come on. Take a walk with Dr. George.
Dr. George is playing the piano there, too.
Yes.
Take a walk with Dr. George. It's only history.
Ragtime.
Yes.
It's not a mystery.
It's not just walks. It is boats, buses, bikes, and trains as well. That was Grant Livingston. Thank you, Michael Stock.
Yes.
Once again. Of course, tell us a little bit about your tours, Paul.
We've got a wonderful boat tour coming up off of Dinner Key Sunday. We've got the City Cemetery Halloween tours coming up just before Halloween on a Friday. There'll be two of those. There's a Pinewood Cemetery tour a week from Saturday, which I haven't done in over a dozen years. And that's that.
Where's
little
that?
It's technically in Coral Gables. It seems as if it's in South Miami. It's right off of Sunset and Irwin Road. And it has some amazing pioneers there buried in that cemetery.
Such as?
Well, George Merrick.
I'm sorry?
Merrick.
No, Merrick is in Woodlawn Park. Okay. A lady named Mary Addison, who was a pioneer in the mid-1860s down where the Charles Dering estate is, for example. And then the Roberts family, a Bahamian family, many members are buried there. Some really interesting people.
Okay.
So we've got that. We've got a Spring Garden tour coming up a couple weeks from Sunday, I believe. And that's that lovely neighborhood on the river, historic neighborhood. So a lot of things going on.
And Bonnie, the number to call?
The number to call is 305-375-1621 for Dr. Paul George's tours or classes that he gives. He gives five classes.
Right, at History of Miami and Miami, South Florida History.
And
yes.
History of Miami, and you can go to historymiami.org
right,
as well. Right.
Okay, well, not to negate the early and mid-70s, but we have to move right along because we have, unfortunately, so much crime. We're going to move to, 1979, Paul.
Well, we've got and this really, I think, brought a whole new twist to Miami in terms of crime. Up until that time, the obsession had been gambling and American organized crime families, as well as just the banality of crime, everyday crime. But suddenly there's a shootout at the Dadeland Mall, which would go on to become the busiest suburban mall in the United States, involving the so-called cocaine cowboys, the members apparently of some drug cartels coming out of Colombia. And they sprayed some bullets in Crown Liquor Store and killed a couple people in the process, and it made national headlines. And what had been, I think, bubbling beneath the surface up until that time, that the cocaine trade had really grown in the area, and now became, very much a part of the area. as far as people's awareness of it.
Finding bodies in cars at the airport were so routine they weren't even mentioned in the newspaper.
It just became matter of fact. It was an everyday occurrence.
You had the Black Widow involved there.
Well, and it's interesting with the Cocaine Cowboy thing, because Ground Zero would probably be the Mutiny Hotel and Lounge over there,
right,
where you began to see these kind of unusual-looking people, flashing a lot of money and apparently cocaine dealers, many of them coming from Latin America. What's interesting about the shootout at Dayland Mall was that the police described the vehicle, it was like an early version of an SUV, as a war wagon, and it was just filled with automatic weapons. They looked at the odometer, 37 miles on it when it drove up there and was abandoned. So it was something quite new.
And paid for but in cash, of course.
Of course, of course. No record. Yeah. No record of anything. So I thought that was a very large moment in the area's history, because for the next several years, that becomes part of a component of what we call the Paradise Lost era, when Miami becomes a place of rioting and refugees and drug dealing and drug executions and what have you. But also in 79, we've got, of all things, the Ted Bundy trial.
Was that one of the first, I guess he would be called a serial killer, right?
Right.
And was that one of the first where they went after, I know it was in Gainesville at University of Florida, isn't that where he
right.
took
well,
most
he
of
actually,
his victims?
He killed, we believe, he wasn't really tried for him, several young women at Florida State. And I was in Tallahassee at the time it happened, and it was just a horrendous situation, one of whom I knew, in fact, one of the victims. But they nailed him on two. He was convicted of two young women's homicides in this case. He was his own attorney, and it was televised.
And it was down here.
It was down here in Miami. That's why we brought it up. Or something.
I think, do you know Shirley Henderson?
Yes,
the
of course,
artist.
Sure.
I think she was there doing the courtroom sketches.
Yeah. Actually, I forget this. I covered the Ronnie Zamora trial, which was televised locally.
It was
on Channel 2.
And television was blamed for that,
that was
by Ruben.
Yes,
by
Ellis Ruben. His defense was that Ronnie Zamora had seen too much violence on TV. I covered that for the CBC back then.
Wow,
I forgot about
we
it.
We forgot about that one.
Right in this era, in fact. Right in this era. And it's interesting, when Bundy was convicted, the judge told him, as they took him out of the courtroom, "You would have made a great attorney, except you took the wrong road." And then the judge went back to his chamber and cried. And we believe that he was complicit. Bundy was in more than 40 murders of young women.
40.
In fact, he was executed at Rayford, and outside of his holding area before his execution, people just clamored with pots and pans, just waiting for him to be executed.
Was that one of the biggest serial
killers,
though, at that point?
It had to be, and I think even through today.
And his magnetism, that he was the perfect psychopath.
Yes.
He still had women wanting to marry him after these details of these crimes.
It's unreal, unreal. In fact, either he was married while he was a prisoner, or he had somebody who was very close to him, a woman. Mm. It was an unbelievable story. I have actually seen the pictures of him after he was executed.
I have, too. You can see them online if you look for them.
Joe always looks for stuff like that. Okay, which brings us to 1980, which was just rife with horrible.
It was. There's so many things were bubbling in the middle of December of 1979. Arthur McDuffie, a black insurance executive on a kind of a joyride on his motorcycle running through a lot of lights, was eventually cornered by several policemen and was plunged into death over at where the expressway embankment is, 195 to Miami Beach, at 38th Street and North Miami Avenue.
Right.
And, of course, they covered it up to make it appear as if his motorcycle had, thrown him off and what have you. And the case was tried out of Miami. Judge Nesbitt was the judge. And these four policemen were acquitted up in Orlando. And this was May 17th when word got out. This is about a month after the Mattel boat lift had begun.
Maybe it was Tampa, Paul.
It might have been Tampa.
I think
it might have been Tampa.
Yeah.
It was about a month after the Mattel boat lift. Things were unsettled as it was, and there had been a lot of grievances in the black community about police treatment right up to that time. For example, a man named LaFour, his home had been invaded by policemen looking for some miscreant, and it was the wrong house. The reaction was on 62nd Martin Luther King Drive, as well as outside of Janet Reno's office in the what would be the Gerstein Justice Building today. Tremendous demonstrations. Cars were toppled. Fires were set. The riot was on. It was 3.5 days. About 18 deaths. $100 million in property damage. Adjudged to be the costliest race riot up to that time in American history. And you know, it spread to many different neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods.
I remember viewing that scene from the 16th floor next door on the top of the roof of Lindsay Hopkins after the Norton Tire had gone up on Northwest 7th
that
Avenue.
Black smoke coming up. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was horrendous. Yeah. And they had martial law was in effect here.
Yes, it was.
All liquor sales were cut off.
And Marvin Dunn is still looking for some kind of monument to mark where McDuffie was.
He is.
I was reminded of that.
Yes, he is.
Just east of 27th Avenue, over in the Brownsville area, there's an Arthur McDuffie Boulevard, a subname for one of the streets over there. I noticed. Which is odd, but. Because we talked about that.
Right.
Some sort of a plaque or something.
Acknowledge
Arthur McDuffie.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, I mean, everything just seemed to be hitting the bottom. And, of course, the whole drug thing was becoming more apparent. These large cartels had representatives here. 125,000 Mario refugees. One of the opening scenes in Scarface, part of which was shot on Miami Beach and elsewhere a couple years later, is in Tent City under the expressway, which was created by the federal government. To house about 300 Montiels in the summer of 1980. So just everything seemed to focus on the problems that we were experiencing at that time.
You know, a lot of blame was put on those refugees, and indeed Castro did send criminals and mental patients, but also a lot of people who really were painted with a broad brush.
Right. And a sociologist years later did, he studied that whole thing, and he said it was highly exaggerated in terms of the percentage of people adjudged to be either felons or people with mental disabilities, and that we had really exaggerated that.
It helped bring down Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, it certainly did.
Oh, yeah.
It certainly did.
Well, let's move to the murder that changed America in 1981 of Adam Walsh.
Right. Adam Walsh was this wonderful little boy, and he was in a mall with his mom in Hollywood, Florida. And she wandered off just for a moment to look at something, left him in the toy department. And a guy, as it turned out, Otis Toole, a drifter out of, I believe, North Florida, would lure him away and ultimately decapitated him. And Toole passed away, but had confessed to this before his passing that he was involved many years later. Up in Vero Beach, I believe, was it the head that was found?
They found the head not that long after in Vero Beach.
Right, yeah. But it was something that went national and international and just sickened all of us.
And then his father, you know, in his quest for, you know, justice or not justice, well, justice for others, became that host on America's Most Wanted. And then they passed that Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act.
And started the database for missing children.
Yeah.
Right. And John Walsh continues to be involved in a lot of these things, as well as a television show, I believe. Has been for a long time. But it was something that really sickened us.
If someone wants to learn all about that case, if they read the book by Les Standerford, it's called Missing Adam.
Yeah, Standerford's a fine writer.
We had him on. Yeah. Look at that book. You really get the insight.
And it was the detective in Broward that...
Yeah, Joe
Matthews?
Joe Matthews, yeah.
That broke the case,
I guess. It's off the top of my head. But
I think that... Yeah. So that's up to 1981. What else do we have?
There was so much going on at that time. The Time magazine cover story, I think, recognized the problems that we had so acute. November of 1981, Paradise Lost, that Florida, but especially Miami, was drowning in crime and drowning in handling refugees and things of that nature. So we had that going on, and then we had some police shootings in the 1980s in Overtown that brought about a riot. One riot broke out in 1982 after a man named Neville Johnson was shot in Overtown.
Just up the street here.
Just up the street. And there was rioting. At an arcade. And the rioting broke out right at that moment. And then I think something even more severe in terms of rioting when a policeman, William Lozano, shot an unarmed motorcyclist at the end of the 80s, 1989, within 2 weeks of the Super Bowl. And there was fires in Overtown and riot in other black neighborhoods. Just as the media was descending on Miami to cover the whole pre-Super Bowl extravaganza. So it was a tough time for Miami and the police and dealing with minority communities at that point.
Okay, we're going to stop right there at the 80s in our crime series, part three and final part of our crime series with Dr. Paul George, the resident historian at History Miami Museum. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. So what year was this, Joe? I know you were a big fan.
I rarely watched it. Like 86 or something?
Paul, when was Miami Vice?
It aired in August, September of 84 and went off in 89. And I mean,
is there anything you don't know?
No.
You know, we did a concert series with Philip Michael Thomas.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah.
And in North Miami.
Yeah, the theater there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that, of course, that was the theme song.
So we worked with him some, so we got to know him a little
Miami
bit.
Miami Vice, did you?
In fact, he'd be working on his lines sometimes before our meetings.
Did you learn anything?
He was a great guy.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's interesting because it cast Miami, once again, in a crime light, but it brought such publicity to the area that I think one of the things that helped re-energize South Beach or energize it was Miami Vice. You know, did a lot of shooting in that area. As did, to some degree, Scarface, which was shot over there in 82 and aired in 83. Scarface had such problems down in the lower tip of the beach, which was really in bad shape at that time, crime-wise and otherwise, that they moved some of those shoots back to Los Angeles. That's how tough it was in that area.
I mean, they couldn't even shoot it there.
They couldn't do it there.
I never understood the popularity of that movie.
It was Al Pacino, for one thing.
But all he did was scream.
And Michelle Pfeiffer.
All he did was scream in it.
He was portraying drug lords. So.
And the decapitation scene took place in the Sunray Apartments. The building's still there.
It had
a Johnny Rockets at one point. So that just underlined, I think, the nadir of the area in terms of crime. And, you know, is it out of control completely? Early 80s. But, you know, we'd get back on our feet somehow.
I remember friends of mine up north would say, how can you live down there?
I heard
there?
The same
how
thing.
How can you live down there? You say, well, If you stay out of places that you shouldn't be,
right.
Really, it's not like living in any other city.
Right, right.
You keep your nose clean.
All right. So, what year does that bring us to? Does that bring us to?
Well, we're up to the mid '80s, and the Miami River Cops case was a very interesting case. There was such a stir on the heels of the Mateo boat lift and the Liberty City riot that the city of Miami, under a lot of pressure, and I think a lot of assistance, hired a lot of policemen. New placement, and they really didn't look at their backgrounds. And so you had a lot of rogue cops. And some were in collusion with drug smugglers, bringing in cocaine and what have you. And one of the meeting places was near Jones's Boatyard on the Miami River, technically the Miami Canal. And one night in midsummer of 1985, these rogue policemen ripped off these cocaine dealers and pushed about six in the canal / river, three of whom couldn't swim. And they drowned, and their floating bodies were discovered the next day. It became, again, an international incident and case. And it led to dismissal, probation, conviction.
There were 100 arrests, and fired and suspended. 20 cops served time.
It's absolutely amazing. The department was really in bad shape at that point as a result of this. And it just added more fuel to this whole image that had been going on now for 6 or 7 years, that you couldn't even trust your police.
Yeah.
So the River Cops case was a big case. And it went on for a long time. Those trials, Joe, went on for many years after.
A cop named Rudy Arias turned state's evidence and gave the evidence that convicted most of the 20 who served time.
What was the evidence? Do you know?
Of that they were shaking down the drug deal.
They were complicit in this
thing. So he had actually...
And speaking of drugs, what's interesting is the next year was another celebrated crime when Joyce Cohen would be convicted of murdering her husband, Stanley Cohen, in his sleep. Not her herself. She hired three hitmen from the Northeast. And a guy named Frank Zuccarello turned evidence against her. And incidentally, he testified that she paid them off with, among other things, $100,000 in cocaine. And she was convicted, but she wasn't even arrested and charged until about 2 years later, was convicted and went off to a life term. She's somewhere in Florida.
God, you know, I just thought of another one we didn't talk about. The Fountain Blue. What was his name? The owner, the son of the owner of the Fountain Blue?
Oh, of the...
Novak.
Novak.
Yes, Novak's son,
and
yes.
He, remember how he was killed?
Right. And that was not that long ago.
Cause
no.
Of the assassination.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, when was that? Yeah.
In the early 90s,
I think. Oh, was it that late?
Back? Okay.
Okay. All right. And when was Yahweh Ben Yahweh?
Well, the Yahwehs came to town in 79 and established themselves on the edge of Liberty City. And Yahweh Ben Yahweh claimed to be, you know, a direct connection with God and the prophets and what have you.
And for the community, as a community value to that organization.
Right. Well,
in
they,
1990, before he was indicted, the city of Miami proclaimed Yahweh Ben Yahweh Day throughout the city at a city commission meeting.
And gave him a key to the city, too.
Yeah.
And then
oh,
the
no.
indictments came for racketeering, for murder, and there were lots of convictions. I think there were Robert Rozier, who had been a former pro football player, confessed to 7 homicides. And so that broke the organization in the early 90s. Those trials took place around 92.
And also you could, they threw in some arson along the way, too.
They didn't miss much.
Yeah. That was Hulon Mitchell.
Hulon Jr. Mitchell from Oklahoma, in fact.
And his sister was an opera singer who performed at the Met.
Oh, my gosh. Mm. And so he would go away for a long prison term, but got out and then eventually died of prostate cancer. It was an absolute mess. And their complex was a little bit west of 27th Avenue along 62nd Street. And they had, you know, invested pretty heavily in the community, and they were perceived as doing good for the community in many ways. But when all this came out, oh, my gosh.
Not only a cult, but a murderous cult.
Yeah, murderous, yeah. I think it was decapitation, at least, in one of those homicides.
Does that bring us to 1997?
It does, and one of the most celebrated crimes in Miami history, Johnny Versace, who was really beloved on the beach, a kind of down-to-earth guy, an internationally renowned designer. We all know the story. In fact, he had a store on the beach on Washington Avenue and about 8th Street, and a former SNL bank. And Johnny, whenever he came to Miami, would enjoy walking down Ocean Drive. Got a cup of coffee with the second Monday in July of 1997, bought about $20 worth of out-of-country magazines at the News Cafe, where he had his cup of coffee. He was walking back, and this maniac, Andrew Cunanan, was standing under a sea grape tree across from his palace, if you will, the only house on Ocean Drive, between 11th and 12th, of course, on the west side of Ocean Drive, and put a gun to his head and fired twice. Mm-hmm. And Johnny died within minutes. And Cunanan would beat it on foot up to North Beach, eventually commandeer a boat on the Indian Creek, committed suicide about 10 days later.
I remember that day I was stuck in the traffic when the cops were catching him on Indian Creek.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
It was a lockdown.
How long was it after?
About 10 days, the following week.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in on today's program, we're talking about South Florida crime history, of course. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or email, that might be easier and faster, radio@wlrn.org.
You know, I was thinking, we haven't even gone near white-collar crime in
right.
terms of, I mean, the...
Corruption. Good old corruption.
And right. corruption right. and political corruption.
Yes.
And then the city of Miami voter fraud.
Right.
And we haven't even...
We haven't even touched that. It's just not as flashy or as crazy as some of these homicides we've covered. Fortunately, unfortunately. And that
or the election of 2000.
Exactly. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And there's so much else. You know, we was just watching something on Hurricane Andrew last night, and the amount of looting and shooting that went on
after the
in South Dade afterwards was outrageous, even with the National Guard all over the place.
We're doing a program tomorrow with Brian Norcross about Hurricane
on
Andrew.
The 25th anniversary.
History of Miami tomorrow night, speaking, in
yeah.
fact, on the 25th, yeah.
So, and we also had the Democratic and Republican conventions in 1972.
Right, 72.
Wasn't there a lot of stuff that happened?
Well, there was, in Born on the 4th of July, a movie
yes.
centered on that.
Who was
that? Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Was in that. And it's interesting because Rocky Pomerantz, who's the Miami Beach police chief, a large, jovial
yes.
guy, and as the story goes, he was quoting Plato to the demonstrators. Many were arrested. There was some violence on Washington Avenue in front of the convention center, but probably less than we had anticipated. for that. They were in a makeshift camp where you had yippies and hippies and demonstrators in Flamingo Park, and they would wander over to the convention each day.
I think it's interesting, though, that we had the Republican convention in 68, and I said to Joe before the program, I said, why could we have the Republican in 68 and the Republican and Democratic in 72?
Because San Diego backed out of, for whatever reason, the Republican convention in 72, so it was a last-minute choice to bring them back to Miami Beach.
But security also. They could just cut off the causeways, and everybody would be isolated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great point.
They really
point.
Anticipated a lot more than what happened, too, especially the Republican convention with Richard Nixon there. In fact,
after 68, people were nervous about things.
Of course.
Chicago.
By the way, we have lots of callers that are ringing right now, and Richard will get to you as soon as he can. So just hang in there. All right. So, yeah. And then we were talking yesterday also about, this wasn't a crime, but it is a point of interest, that Richard Nixon had that house on Key Biscayne, or B.B. Rebozo did, the compound.
Right. George Smathers was a good friend of Nixon's, you know, different political party, but a good friend, sold him the house. It was a Mackle-built house. The compound was about five homes. B.B. was his next-door neighbor. Some really interesting people lived there. But that Nixon friendship with Rebozo was an amazing friendship, and B.B. told me personally how it evolved beginning in 1950. First time he met Nixon, didn't like him. He was standoffish, kind of cold. Nixon invited himself back down to Key Biscayne in 51. They became fast friends.
He bought the house from Elpenelp.
I'm sorry?
Did he buy the house from
Elpenelp? Well, Elpenelp was part of the compound. I thought for some reason it was Smathers, but I could stand corrected on that. But Elpenelp actually still had a house in that compound, too, I believe.
He was the king of the aerosol spray can.
Exactly. At least he was
at a time.
He's lucky he did it then, because today he would have a lot of problems selling aerosol spray cans.
Yeah, that's right.
Very lucky.
Michelle says, you forgot to mention the famous case of Jimmy Rice.
Oh, yeah.
She said to... I don't know if it's Michelle or Michael. That case, to me, had one of the largest impacts on
that
the community
really started
and a huge
the,
impact on federal laws to protect children.
That really
children.
Started the milk carton business.
Oh, okay. That's the one,
putting
Jimmy
missing,
Rice.
Missing children.
Yeah, really, really sad story down in Deep South Dade, agricultural area. It was abducted and murdered and by a field worker who has recently arrived, too, from Cuba to the United States. And it just broke everybody's hearts. In some ways, it's like what we said yesterday about Skiggy Cash or Adam Walsh. You know, how you prey on young people is just beyond me.
And then, I guess this is before the time we're talking about. Sam writes about the Chillingworth murders in Palm
Beach. That was 1955, and the assailants weren't prosecuted, Bobby Lincoln and Joe Peel, until 1962. So that's way back when.
Okay, you want to...
Let's go to Doug in Fort Lauderdale. Doug, you're up. Hi.
How you doing? I used to work back in the early 80s. I know you're dipping into the 90s now, but I worked at the Executive House in Inverary, and that was owned and operated by the Teamsters Union, so may I say anymore. In fact, Tony Provenzano's daughter worked at the front desk.
Oh, boy.
I don't suppose Jimmy Hoffa was buried there, though, right?
Well, they're not sure. There was the word that he may be under the foundation. So,
Meadowlands.
Anyway, my boss, Cesar Vitale, got murdered, he and his wife. And it was odd several months before. He said, everybody's expendable. And I go, what do you mean by that, C? And he goes, just remember that.
Boy, that's an ominous warning.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. So... And they wanted me to go up to their, which I did go up there, to their restaurant in New Jersey, one of their restaurants, controlling the restaurants, and they wanted me to be the maitre d'. And my father said, you get in with these guys, you're not getting out. So I said, just strongly, son, you don't do it.
So good for you. Good idea, Doug.
Yeah. We're glad you're still here with us, Doug, and healthy.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling.
All right. Buddy.
Okay, and we'll move along now to a Kendall caller. Here's Juan in Kendall.
Yeah, hi. Just to remind, remembering the assassination of the founder of Miami Subs, his last name was Boulos. He was a Greek immigrant.
Gus Boulos, yes.
Gus Boulos, and he was gunned down in Hustler's Boulevard. It was a hit, a mob hit.
Right at the beginning of the 2000s, in fact. That case went for a long time without...
Is that the one on the boat?
Well, he had the boat. He had the boat to nowhere type of thing. He had a boat and Miami Subs and everything else. But he was actually gunned down near the water, I believe near Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, it was the quintessential execution style, two cars kind of bracketed his car, and the rest is history. But thank you.
Yep.
Okay, and, you know, I'll go ahead.
Okay, let's take line four. Samuel in Miami. Samuel, hi.
Hello, how are you doing? Dr. George, do you remember a killing at off of Lejeune at a hotel over there where some tourists came in and they were checking in their hotel and their young son was snatched and beheaded by someone living in one of the rooms?
I don't. You know, unfortunately, there have been so many, as you and I both know, homicides that I don't. I know about the German tourist abductions and all, but I don't think this relates to it. But how long ago was that?
This was the same time in the 60s and the 70s. It was had because I was working at the international airport at the time.
Okay. No, I don't. Mm-hmm. But thank you so much for bringing it up.
Yes. Thank you.
One other item.
Yes.
I used to work with a guy who, before the mob really got involved in the drug trade, the locals could make a pretty good dollar. He would go to the Jamaica and bring in boatloads of cocaine, but marijuana.
Right.
And he was caught in Biscayne Bay by the Coast Guard, and he blew his boat up and he jumped overboard. And they found bales of marijuana floating in the bay, and he swam away from it.
Okay.
And he left Miami and retired later on.
Oh, okay. He made it.
It was a good idea to leave Miami. Yes,
he got in and got out.
Okay. Right,
thanks for your call.
All right, thank you.
Let's talk about the tourist killings.
Yeah,
that really had a big effect on us here. The tourism, of course, it even had to change the license plate system because the rental cars.
Right.
You could tell a rental car, so people could logically say, "Oh, that's probably a tourist. They probably have cash."
Yes, of course. You know, coming out of the airport or what have you, driving on the expressways over to Miami Beach and. Sometimes getting
lost.
It's
so easy to get lost in there.
And that's what happened. They got lost in a lot of places, and you know, some were robbed and killed as a result of that. We're talking now the second half of the 90s primarily. But I think changing that rental car license tag thing was helpful.
Deal.
And we didn't hear much about it after that. But the Visitors Bureau and people like that were just, you know, besides himself for good reason when that happened.
What was the Operation Courtroom?
Judges and some attorneys collaborated to fix cases and kickbacks and bribes and what have you, and it led to the conviction of a couple of circuit court judges. And we're talking now in the early 2000s or late 1990s.
It was right when Topical Currents began, which was in 1999.
Right.
I had a couple of guests on talking about that, Tony Doris and Dan Ricker covered some of that stuff too. Yeah,
a lot of corruption at that point in the courts.
Let's.
We haven't talked about Murph the Surf. Go
okay,
ahead.
Well, that's the 60s, of course. Kim and Dania, hi, you're up.
Oh, thank you, Joseph and Bonnie, for your exceptional broadcast, as always. Well, I just want to say, hey, you know, I'm alive to talk to you because I was a victim of a murder for hire. My significant other for 12 years, we lived in Southlake in Hollywood. Our families knew each other. And because I wouldn't terminate a pregnancy, he went on US-1 to try to solicit a prostitute to make it look like a robbery and bash my stomach with a baseball bat.
Oh.
Fortunately, she went to the police, thank the good Lord, and they wired her because they... you know, didn't think anyone would believe her, and that's what he expected, and he had a lot of cash to give her.
Kim, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you. Your case sounds horrible, but it's not really a very well-known case to our listeners. We're trying to do that
more. It's not very well-known. It was the first hour-long Dateline. It was headline news.
Well, you didn't present it where we could really understand that.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate because... you know, they have to know about people that live through these ordeals, and that was very high profile, more so than all that you have been talking about. Of course, you have been talking about dead bodies, but here was someone that lived, and I think Hollywood police, for all their good work and for all of Court TV and Dateline, of course, and all of the other shows that did bring it to light, and the Miami Herald.
Well, Kim, we're glad that you made it, and we're glad you're here to tell us the story.
And so are my twins.
Oh, wow.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Okay, well, we're glad. Thank you.
Florida versus Luskin.
Okay.
Bye now.
Thank you.
And we'll move along to Michael in Pembroke Pines. Michael, you're up. Hi.
Yeah, two things. Number one, Gus Bolus was sandwiched in by two cars on Miami Road just north of State Road 84 in Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, I don't know if you've talked, I tuned in late. The young girl who was kidnapped out of her house off of 13th Avenue and a car away, and they dumped her body down in Dinner Key. I believe it was Rosenberg.
Judith Ann Roberts, yes. The summer of 1954, right. And that was one of the absolute worst of these homicides that we've discussed, yes.
And they never solved it.
They never did.
I have to tell you, I couldn't wait. I had to sleep in my parents' bed that night.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
My hearing.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling. So are we going to run down what we think are the worst?
I don't know about the worst, Joe? But the most celebrated.
What about the worst? The most, I don't know. Which most impresses?
Well, how about ladies first?
No.
Paul, I'll take a shot at
you
it.
You take
and
a
it's,
shot.
It's so coincidental, our last caller. I think the one that was the worst, and for me the most memorable, I was a little boy at the time, was the Judith Ann Roberts killing. Kidnapping, sexual abuse, and killing at the intersection of South Bay Shore Drive and Kirk Avenue and Coconut Grove, near Dinner Key, as our caller said, in July of 1954, unsolved. And when I do my crime tour, which I do periodically for History of Miami, I had the detective, his name was Whitman, who later became an attorney, on the tour when he was in his late 80s. And he said, you know, I'm still trying to solve that case. He died in his early 90s not too long ago. And, of course, the case remains unsolved. Prime suspects included the father and the grandfather. She was visiting from Baltimore. She was 6 years of age. And she was taken out of her grandparents' home. Very quiet neighborhood. I grew up a block away. And it was something that just was seared in my memory.
Okay.
But ladies first?
Ladies first. I think for me, the racial crimes are the worst. Even the McDuffie murder. But the lynchings, and there were so many of them, but the one off Davie Boulevard in the western outskirts of Fort Lauderdale, Reuben Stacy,
yes.
And that was 1935. Yes. And then the one of Claude Neal, although he was lynched up in Mariana,
mm-hmm.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Mariana.
Mariana, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think those for me are the worst because they're horrendous, and the way they were killed and mutilated and
usually
tortured.
There's a crowd there oftentimes
and that's
almost
it.
Cheering on this thing.
Well, that's just it. And Fred Grimm wrote about this many years ago, and one of the things well, 2 years ago, and he was talking about these girls watching this lynching of Reuben Stacy. He writes, in their nice city dresses, they were among hundreds of white people who had come out to enjoy the public spectacle that July day. It was the bemused expression on the children's faces that was so unsettling. That's just, yeah. I mean, I think those for me.
My choice will be the Mosler murder because of the local impact. I don't think anything had the local impact with the newspapers, with special editions and that. Plus it had murder, millions of dollars, beauty, a queen, the infidelity and incest, and also that they were acquitted, even though it was sort of an O.J. Simpson kind of thing.
Yes.
Where it was,
yes.
A little debatable there. So.
Right.
Well, this has been kind of fun doing these three segments we've done, Paul.
Yes, it has been.
I want to bring up also how much I've enjoyed working you. Or some people might not be aware that I'm retiring, and Bonnie is going to stay with the station, but Topical Currents will be having its last episode at the end of September. And Paul, we've been doing this almost 20 years together.
We have.
Over 50 history quiz programs. Those have been so much fun.
It's been wonderful.
Such a big part of the program. I want to certainly thank you for all of that.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. It's been just great. And I still run into people who said, I've heard you on Topical Currents. Yeah, just as I have in the last couple of days. In fact, it's been marvelous. And we've been friends for a long time. We'll continue to be for a long time.
Well, I've got some projects for you maybe we can work on together.
Would love it. Would love it.
I ran into a photographer yesterday, Barry Feldman, actually, who said, don't go. It's like I'm going to be losing one of my best friends. You know, it's like losing a good friend, Topical Current. So, yeah, it's
been
be
a long
hard.
Run.
You've done a great job.
19 and 18 and three quarters years.
Yeah.
By the end of September.
You need to get some rest.
I've loved it. I've loved it so much, as you can probably tell.
Yes.
Well, we certainly want to thank you for tuning in to today's program, South Florida Crime History. Many thanks to Dr. Paul George, of course. And if you didn't hear all of today's program or missed an edition of the crime series, it's easy to download free audio archives of each one at our website. That's WLRN.org. Today's program was technical direction by Michael Stock, who's also been a longtime contributor to this program. Richard Ives is lead producer. Polly Landis is associate producer. Our online content is being put up these days while Jason is on vacation by Peter J. Maritz.
And yes, so you can still, it's not up there quite as quickly, but it's up there every day. So Facebook or WLRN.org.
And tomorrow's program celebrates, well, not exactly the right word, Hurricane Andrew's dramatic landfall in South Florida. We'll visit with one of the true heroes of the storm, meteorologist Brian Norcross. We'll hear about his version of the storm and its impact. He's written a memoir about it. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and the good doctor, Paul George, thanks for making public radio your companion today and every day. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.